Lecture 6, Epic Literature, Ramayana.
The story of a devoted husband and wife, separated by evil forces and then reunited after overcoming great travails, has universal human appeal. But this theme has reached its literary peak in the Hindu tradition. Widely recognized as the first major work of Sanskrit literature, the Ramayana recounts the life of Rama, the perfect prince, and his faithful wife, Sita, as she's abducted by a demon king and then liberated by her husband after a cosmic battle. Emically, many Hindus today regard the Ramayana as the divine Rama's absolutely true life history. In contrast, for many outside or Edic readers, this massive poem provides an unmatched source for understanding the extended history of ancient Indian society and culture, especially of the elite class of kings and warriors who dominated the emerging kingdoms of North India from the 6th century BCE over the next 9 centuries. In this lecture, we'll start with an examination of the nature of the Ramayana as the premier example of Kavya, a leading Sanskrit poetic genre. We'll note its differences and similarities with classical Greek and Latin epics, and also with today's ideas about history writing. As we briefly recount the narrative of the life of its hero, Rama, we'll discuss what we as Edic historians can learn about the political, social, and cultural world that the Ramayana describes. We'll end by looking at how diverse Indian and Southeast Asian people have used the Ramayana over time down to the present. In its genre and scope, the Ramayana is often compared by Western readers with Homer's Odyssey and Virgil's Aeneid. Each is a work of literature, but each also conveys the history of a divinely descended man. Homer's Odysseus has as an ancestor the Greek messenger god Hermes. Aeneas, Virgil tells us, is the son of the Roman goddess Venus. And Rama, according to many tellers of his life, is an avatara or birth on earth in human form of the god Vishnu. Each of these massive poems also tells us much about their authors' respective cultural and social worlds, although in differing ways. One repeated criticism by outsiders has been that, unlike that of the West, Indian history writing does not have any real biographies. But the Ramayana is the life story of Rama. In Emic terms, Rama is the god Vishnu born on earth, but he's still born as a human with human limitations and the life story. Further, one main purpose of Rama's birth and of the Ramayana itself is to teach moral behavior, dharma, to people. Many Western biographers also use their subject's life to teach moral lessons, and many people read them in order to find role models to emulate or avoid. So in this sense, the life story of Rama compares to the genre of biography. But since the Rama of the Ramayana was, in Edic terms, not a real person, many outsiders might not consider this text a real biography, but rather the amalgamation of some possible historical facts about one or more princes compiled over a long period of time. This text also reflects the larger historical processes of Sanskrit-speaking North Indians spreading their influence across the Dravidian language-speaking South. The setting of the Ramayana includes some very real places and social formations. Recall that from about the 6th century BCE onward, especially in the North Indian Gangetic Plain, hundreds of locally based Janapadas, or people's places, were developing into small kingdoms. One of these kingdoms was Kosala, with its capital at Ayodhya, where the Ramayana begins and ends. Most of these kingdoms had a Raja, a king, who fought or allied with his neighbors to expand or just to survive. Gradually, Kshatriya martial dharma, or code for moral conduct, became the model for many of these competing and collaborating kings and princes, first in North India and then in parts of Central and South India as well. In most North Indian Hindu kingdoms, some Brahmins served this royalty as advisors, priests, teachers, genealogists, or bards. The Ramayana may have begun as a bardic epic by a courtier about a noble prince of Ayodhya. Beneath Brahmins and Kshatriyas, and ideally under their protection, were merchants, peasants, artisans, and other subjects. But they do not appear very often in the Ramayana, except as attendants on the royal court, or as subjects seeking redress of grievances from the king, or as foot soldiers in their armies. So the Ramayana is mainly an elite text, primarily focused on Rajas, their extended families, their supporters, servants, and enemies, both demonic and human. Now, emic and Eddic ideas about the complex authorship of the Ramayana differ in significant ways, based on different ways of knowing history. A leading emic view credits the sage Valmiki with composing the most authoritative original Sanskrit telling of the Ramayana. But the emic view also presents the author differently from how Eddic historians might understand the role either of an historian or a creative writer of literature. In Valmiki's own telling, he himself only participates as a relatively minor figure in the actual events of the Ramayana. Valmiki was a reformed bandit who had achieved great merit through becoming a forest-dwelling ascetic. It is in his rustic hermitage where the main figures, Rama and his wife Sita, rest early in their travels. Toward the end of the Ramayana, Sita returns to take refuge in Valmiki's hermitage to give birth and raise Rama's and her twin sons. So as an eyewitness, Valmiki personally participates relatively little in the events. Instead, as the Ramayana explains, Valmiki hears Rama's whole story from the demigod Narada, and then is ordered by the creator god Brahma to retell it. Valmiki also meditates deeply and gains cosmic insights about what has happened, learning things that he had not known before. So in the emic tradition, Valmiki bases his account on divine information and guidance, not primarily on his being an eyewitness. Finally, Valmiki teaches the Ramayana to Rama's own sons, who recite it for the first time in public to Rama himself, who would have corrected any errors, if there had been any. Therefore, in its own emic terms, the truth of this story can't be doubted. But what did Valmiki actually personally create? Here, the emic tradition credits Valmiki with inventing the specific 32-syllable poetic meter called a shloka, in which the Ramayana and various other classical Sanskrit poems were recited. But how did Valmiki come up with the shloka meter? In the Ramayana, Valmiki himself explains that he was observing two birds in loving union. Just then, a forest-dwelling human hunter, perhaps an Adivasi, shot the male bird dead, leaving the female bird in mortal agony. Valmiki spontaneously cursed the hunter to wander eternally. This curse was in the shloka meter, and that was Valmiki's original contribution, making him the Adikavi, or first poet. Many later authors composed their Sanskrit poetry using the same shloka meter. But in Eddic terms, Valmiki could not have been the sole author of the Ramayana, given its sheer volume and its many centuries of composition. In the current form of the Sanskrit Ramayana attributed to Valmiki, the Ramayana is 50,000 lines long, which is double Homer's Odyssey and Virgil's Aeneid combined. Further, linguists and historians of religion analyze the text as a product of about 900 years of adding to, altering, and editing by many sequential authors, each of whom, however, gave Valmiki credit for the entire text. Now let's turn to the emic life history of Rama as presented in Valmiki's Ramayana. Given the great length of this text, we'll have to concentrate on the account of Rama's life, the main subject, and leave out many of the vast numbers of episodes and the myriad of branch stories interwoven with it. King Dasharatha rules the North Indian kingdom of Ayodhya. While both Eddic and emic scholars agree that this was a real place, the center for an expansive Janapada, there's no Eddic evidence of this particular king. Nonetheless, although the emically real King Dasharatha rules virtuously, he has no male heirs. So he hires Brahmin priests to perform a great sacrifice, earning him much merit. Indeed, out of the sacrificial fire arises a vessel filled with a special rice milk. Each of his three queens consumes some of it, and each becomes pregnant with sons. The middle queen takes two portions, so she has twin sons. While these events are taking place on earth, in heaven, the Hindu gods face a major problem. A ten-headed demon named Ravana himself performed great austerities and an awesome sacrifice, which gained him the power to demand from the gods that he be made invincible against any god or demon. But in his overweening pride, Ravana does not ask to be invulnerable against a human. Arrogantly, Ravana then oppresses Brahmins, disrupting their religious rites and threatening the moral order of the universe. So the great god Vishnu agrees to be born in the world as human and thus able to kill Ravana. Vishnu therefore voluntarily descends to earth, taking birth as Dasharatha's four sons, Rama and his three brothers simultaneously, but mostly as Rama, the son of the elder senior queen. As Valmiki describes in much detail, Rama grows up as a perfect prince, always following his kshatriya dharma. There are long passages where Valmiki recounts how Rama selflessly defeats evil forces, especially respecting and protecting forest-dwelling ascetics. He thus explicitly and implicitly models the ideal behavior for not just princes, but for all Hindus to follow. When Rama is ready to marry, he enters a swayamvara for Sita, the princess of a neighboring kingdom. Swayamvara literally means that a woman chooses her own husband. But the Ramayana describes this as a contest among suitors. Whichever man is able to string a massive bow wins the bride. Only Rama's great merit enables him to win the contest. How then is this the wedding of the bride's own choosing? Well, in emic terms, the bride's own karma or merit determined who would win. In emic terms, Sita is the goddess Lakshmi, that is, Vishnu's wife, voluntarily born on earth in order to be Rama's bride. So this is the inevitable outcome of the contest. In this and many other episodes, the Ramayana shows exactly how the system of karma works. Everything that happens is the appropriate result of the meritorious or demeritorious actions of everyone involved in that action. While the details are, in Edic terms, superhuman, the evidence about bridal and other contests among princes and marriage alliances among kingdoms fits with our other historical evidence about that time period. Eventually, King Dasharatha decides to abdicate and crown Rama as the new king. But as Rama's coronation approaches, his youngest stepmother, Kaikeyi, becomes jealous and schemes to have her own son, Bharata, made the next king. By her meritorious action earlier in her life, Kaikeyi has earned two promises owed to her by King Dasharatha. She uses the first boon to get the reluctant Dasharatha to declare Bharata as his heir, and the second to send Rama into exile into the forest for 14 years. Dasharatha then dies, cursing Kaikeyi for her improper and selfish desire, so she herself gains no advantage from her improper request. This moment of crisis enables Valmiki and the other authors of the Sanskrit Ramayana to illustrate further moral lessons. Rama virtuously accepts his father's order, however reluctantly given, and that goes that very day willingly into exile. His wife Sita voluntarily goes with him, taking on the hardships of forest life, and thus showing how, in emic terms, an ideal wife should act. For his part, the brother Bharata refuses to accept the throne that his mother improperly obtained for him. Instead, he governs in Rama's name, taking on all the burdens of rule with none of the benefits. Bharata is, after all, Vishnu on earth as well, so he illustrates how a younger brother should act respectfully toward his elder brother. One of their middle twin brothers, Lakshmana, also goes with Rama to serve him in the forest, while the other twin, Shatrughna, stays with Bharata to assist him. Much of the lengthy Ramayana recounts the trials and virtues of Rama and Sita in the forest as they travel from Ayodhya south across India. This is where the epic describes the great diversity of the geography and the societies of India. Throughout, Rama exemplifies the proper dharmic behavior in a number of trying situations. In one, a lustful sister of the demon king Ravana, named Sarpanaka, tries to seduce both Rama and his brother Lakshmana. When Rama declines her offer, explaining that he's already married to Sita, Sarpanaka offers to kill her and take Sita's place. Finally, Lakshmana disgraces Sarpanaka for her improper lust. The pivotal point in the Ramayana comes when the demon king Ravana determines to carry off Sita. Ravana does this out of his lascivious lust for her and also to get revenge for his mutilated sister, Sarpanaka. So the demons generally all act with excessive desire. While that is their dharma, they also receive punishments for acting on it. In order to carry off Sita, Ravana has one of his demon courtiers take on the form of a golden deer who prances before Sita and entices her to desire it as a pet. For this, Sita herself begins to accumulate demerits, at least according to the prevailing emic interpretation, that make her vulnerable to being carried off by Ravana. Sita urges Rama to chase after the golden deer. Rama sets off after it as it capers just out of range. But Rama does not accumulate demerit for being deceived by the disguised demon, saying, if it's a deer, there's no harm in hunting it. But if it's a demon, then it's a dharma to kill it anyway. He shoots and mortally wounds the deer-disguised demon. But in his dying breath, this demon cries out in Rama's voice for Lakshmana's help. Hearing this, Sita is again deceived into doubting Rama's prowess and urges Lakshmana to leave her and go help Rama. Lakshmana refuses to leave Sita unguarded, but then she unjustly criticizes him and Lakshmana is thus forced to go. When Ravana approaches in the disguise of a Brahmin mendicant, Sita is again deceived about how to act in accordance with her dharma. She moves forward to offer him food, and thereby comes under Ravana's power. One emic lesson here is that women, even perfect women like Sita, are susceptible to desire and misperception of the true nature of situations. But as Sita is carried off, all her demerits are burned off as well, and thereafter in the Ramayana, Sita always acts in accordance with her dharma. Another result of this abduction is that Ravana's death is now assured. Rama has the dharmic justification to kill him, which was the prime purpose of Vishnu taking birth as Rama on earth in the first place. In order to perform his dharma by recovering Sita, Rama recruits the local population of monkeys and bears as his allies. Most notable among these is Hanuman, a divinely descended monkey who becomes Rama's leading servant and a very popular deity in his own right. Hanuman is known for his strength, and so is worshipped by many wrestlers today. He's also the most faithful servant, and so an emic role model for lower-born people. Rama's local allies search everywhere to no avail. Finally, Hanuman leaps across the water to Lanka, the kingdom of Ravana. Today, most Hindus believe that Hanuman crossed the narrow strait, now called the Gulf of Mannar, between India and Sri Lanka Island. There, Hanuman finds Sita confined, but resistant to Ravana's enticements. Hanuman offers to rescue her himself, but she insists that only Rama should liberate her, since that is his dharma as her husband. Hanuman returns to Rama with the news. But to invade Lanka, Rama and his allies have to build a bridge. This bridge provides a good example of how Edic and Emic evidence coincide and yet also differ. there is indeed a shallow underwater limestone ridge over the 20 miles between South India and Sri Lanka. This ridge is clearly visible from satellite photographs. For Eddic geologists, the underwater ridge has natural causes and needs no sacred source. In Emic terms, however, this bridge was constructed by Hanuman and his allied bears and monkeys, using the power of Rama's name to make it secure, although later storms sank part of his bridge underwater. For many devotees of Rama, these satellite photographs are scientific evidence for the truth of the Ramayana, although that sacred text needs no external proof. In the great war between Rama's forces and Ravana's demon armies, many battles and perils are detailed, each with a moral lesson attached. For instance, at one point, Lakshmana is gravely wounded and about to be carried off by the exultant demons. But Lakshmana remembers that he is Vishnu incarnate and therefore invulnerable. At the same time, however, Lakshmana must be human or he cannot aid in the killing of Ravana. To revive Lakshmana, Hanuman is sent off to a distant mountain to bring back a special healing herb. On his arrival there, he realizes he isn't educated enough to identify the needed medicinal plant. So he cleverly brings back the entire mountain, enabling the physicians at Lakshmana's side to select the herb and cure him. This emically shows how even uneducated servants can cleverly use their brute strength in devoted service to their elite masters. Finally, Rama kills Ravana and liberates Sita. When she rushes to rejoin Rama, however, he repudiates her as having been impure by living under Ravana's power. For some emic commentators, this shows that Rama only acted out of moral duty, not his personal desire for Sita. Other analysts in India and the West critique Rama for blaming the victim, Sita, for her unwilling abduction, just as so many abducted women have been blamed by their family and by society in so many cultures. Valmiki has Sita then enter a sacred fire to prove her purity to the world. Only then does Rama accept her back. To explain his action, Rama proclaims that he knew all along that she was pure. But since less enlightened people might not understand that, he had to demonstrate her purity to them by this fiery test. After the return of Rama and Sita to Ayodhya, they rule as king and queen, completely virtuously. Even today, the phrase Rama Raja, or Rama's reign, conveys for many Orthodox Hindus a period of perfect governance that present-day politicians should imitate. But once again, the unenlightened subjects of Ayodhya misperceive Dharma and begin to ignorantly question Sita's virtue. So Rama feels he must send Sita away, banishing her to Valmiki's hermitage, unaware that she is pregnant with his two sons. As youths, these sons come to Rama's court and recite the Ramayana, which Valmiki has taught them. Then Sita returns to her mother Earth, becoming her divine form of Lakshmi again. Finally, Rama too ends his earthly life and again becomes the god Vishnu. In Eddic terms, Rama may have been a real prince or several princes whom local people deified and then Brahmins later Sanskritized into the Vedic god Vishnu as one of his incarnations. In emic terms, Rama is a beloved deity to whom people can relate, often more accessibly revered than the more distant Vishnu. As filled as the Ramayana is with moral lessons, branch stories, and numerous episodes, it is also a biography of Rama. To many Hindus today, every word of Valmiki's telling is absolute truth. But for many others, Hindus and non-Hindus, the story of Rama could be used for other purposes. After Valmiki, many other authors retold the story of Rama in slightly or greatly different ways. Each region of India has one or more tellings of Rama's story in its own language. For example, Kamban, in the early 13th century, retold the story in Tamil, a prominent Dravidian language of southeast India. Today, there are over 75 million speakers of Tamil, more than the number of people who speak Italian, for example. Yet Tamil is only one of India's many regional languages. Each of these later authors, using his or her own language, highlights different features of Rama's story, removing episodes present in Valmiki's telling, adding others, and thus changing the epic's length, content, and purpose. The 16th century Mughal Emperor Akbar, whom we'll discuss in a later lecture, had his Muslim officials supervise the translation of the Ramayana into the Persian language of his imperial court as a major work of both history and also moral teaching. Many devotional films, for example, in the popular Bollywood and various regional cinema styles, have used parts of the Ramayana as their plot. In recent years, various television producers have used that medium to present the story of Rama. The most famous of these Hindi language television programs were produced and directed by Ramanand Sagar and his production company. He based his telling both on Valmiki and also on the 16th century Tulsidas, the most famous of the retellers of Rama's story in Hindi. Initially, there were 78 episodes broadcast, one each Sunday morning in 1987-88, on the government's official network. Sagar's team then repeatedly remade these for broadcast on other networks over the next 30 years. Many spin-offs, sequels, and other versions have also been broadcast. There have also been many translations and retellings in English, most recently from Valmiki's Sanskrit telling under the general editorship of American scholars Robert and Sally Goldman. But critics of the Brahmanic system of Varnas and Dharma have also used the story of Rama to prove a very different history. For example, there is a substantial jati, or birth group, that proudly calls itself the descendants and followers of Valmiki, although elite Hindus used to class them as untouchable before untouchability became illegal in today's India. So various communities have challenged their low status in the Brahmanic system by using the prestige of the Ramayana. Over the last few centuries, many fiction writers have also used episodes or characters from the Ramayana to convey a variety of messages that clash with those of Valmiki's tellings. Feminist short story authors and playwrights celebrate Sita, often portraying her as a strong, independent woman wronged by an insensitive husband. Some social reformers have critiqued Valmiki's and Tulsidas's orthodox tellings of the life of Rama, claiming those elite authors justify his abuses of his lower class and lower Varna subjects. Most prominently, a cultural nationalist movement in the Tamil-speaking region of South India called the Dravidian Organization, or DK movement, started in the 1930s to attack Brahmin domination. Although Brahmins were a relatively small minority in the Tamil region, they controlled much of the political and economic power there. Under the charismatic E.V. Ramasamy, known as E.V.R., this Dravidian movement pronounced the Ramayana to be the history of an unjust invasion by North Indians. According to E.V.R., Valmiki describes the inhabitants of South India as merely monkeys and bears, and the inhabitants of Sri Lanka as demons. E.V.R. argued in print and dramatized in the streets of that Tamil speakers and other southerners must discredit the Brahmanic religious system that treated them as subhuman. Until they did that, they would remain mentally under the North Indian Brahmanic cultural hegemony or domination. Therefore, E.V.R. mounted massive public processions in which images of Rama were beaten with defiling shoes and pictures of him burnt to show the contempt the Tamils should have for Rama and Brahmanism. Out of this Tamil cultural movement came the political parties that have dominated the government in Tamil Nadu state for many decades. The narrative and sacred power of the Ramayana has meant that it spread beyond India to Southeast Asia, especially in Indonesia, Cambodia, Thailand, and Burma, now Myanmar. In Indonesia, an account of Rama in Old Javanese dates from about 870. One of Java's most popular shadow puppet plays also features the story of Rama. Cambodia's famous 12th century Angkor Wat temple has many stone carved panels and statues illustrating the Ramayana. Then around 1350, the king of Thailand renamed his capital Ayutthaya after Rama's capital Ayodhya. From the 18th century, a Burmese version of the Ramayana became the Burmese national epic. So as we'll see for Buddhism and Islam, Hindu cultural influences spread from India far to the east. But as Rama's story moved, local cultures adapted it to their own cultural values and artistic forms. Although their attitudes toward the story of Rama, their methodologies, and their conclusions often differ, both emic and Edic readers can learn much about the ancient Indian history from Ramayana. In the next couple of lectures, we'll discuss in similar ways the other major Indian epic, the Mahabharata, and its account of ancient Indian history.